accession number 20981. Accession number 20982, wheel 1.
Major Goddard, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In London.
Which year was this?
1920.
Can you tell me a little about your family background, what your father did for a living and so on, please?
Yes, my family came from Suffolk, a farming family from Suffolk. And my father left the farm before the First World War and came to London, where he started up his own company. And I was born in southeast London, educated at grammar school, and at 18 I joined the Territorial Army, and that was really the start of my military career.
Which part of Suffolk did your family come from?
In southeast London.
From Suffolk.
It was Sexmundham.
Which school did you go to in South East London?
I went to the Roan School at Blackheath.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was 16.
Can you tell me about joining the Territorials and what experience you had with them pre-war, please?
Yes, I joined on my 18th birthday, which was November 38. It was a local Territorial battalion of the 20th London Regiment, but it was actually a gunner regiment, and I joined the local battery. We had one camp down at Hayling Island in the middle of 39, and then of course immediately the war started, we were mobilised.
Why had you decided to join TA?
Well, by that time, I think peace in our time had become a non-starter. And I think all my chums realised that they were in for a war, and the best thing to do was to join a local unit where one knew a lot of chums and could fight a war together, probably. It didn't happen that way, actually, but that was what we assumed. Yeah.
What specifically did you get in the way of training pre-war?
Well, it was, in fact, this became a searchlight battery. And so we were trained on sound locators and searchlights. And it was under that circumstance that we were deployed down on the Romney Marshes immediately the war started. The searchlight element of it actually didn't operate very much, except possibly during the Battle of Britain. But probably the most interesting thing that I can record is that my detachment, which was based at Lydd, in the mid-1940s, was given the responsibility of patrolling the coast between Camber Sands and Dymchurch, which actually was the were the beaches that Sea Lion was due to land on. And it was really rather comical, because at that stage we had no military vehicles. Most of the stuff had gone over to lost at Dunkirk. We were given three London taxis. We had rifles with five rounds of ammunition. We had a 1914-18 Lewis gun in an anti-aircraft and land roll. And as I say, we patrolled the beaches in London taxis. And they were... they were barbed wired, obviously, and mined, and so on. And we did actually pick up a number of fifth columnists who landed on those beaches. And the only other exciting thing we did was to pick up German airmen who bailed out during the Battle of Britain.
Can you tell me about the people you picked up, your personal memories of that, please?
Well, at that time, I was only a junior NCO, and we simply picked up, I think it was a couple of Germans we picked up, who we passed over to intelligence straight away. So, I mean, we didn't interrogate them in any way.
How had they come ashore?
Well, they in boats, in little coracle boats, they came ashore. Mm-hmm.
Any specific details of encountering them?
No, not really. The boats were noted on the beaches, and these people were picked up on the marshes.
Could you be sure they were Germans?
Well, not really. I mean, we passed them over for intelligence interrogation. But as far as the German airmen were concerned, of course, we simply rounded them up and they became prisoners of war.
Did the fifth columnist give you some kind of story when
no.
you...
No, we none of us could speak German, actually, that's that.
What did you think of the sound locators?
Oh, remarkably inaccurate and extraordinarily primitive, really. All the equipment was in those days.
What did the sound locators look like?
Well, they had four, I suppose, microphones at a specific distance. I think about a meter apart horizontally and a meter apart vertically. And we had one had earphones on, and you just directed the sound locators onto the sound of the aircraft, and these were linked to the searchlight. And when you felt you were on target, the searchlight was exposed and then searched around until it found the aircraft, if it found them at all.
What was your job on those?
Well, I think I was a Lance Bombardier in those days, and I was simply in charge of the sound locating section of about three, I think.
Any details you can give about the German airmen who came down?
No, none at all. They were mainly Dornier, Junkers 88s. There were only a few of them survived. I mean, majority of them came down the Bromley Marshes, usually crashed and were killed. But there was the odd survivor that we had very little to do with them except to hand them over.
Did you at that time think the Germans would invade?
Oh, yeah. I think we were pretty sure they would. I mean, we had nothing to stop them. We used to assume, we were told actually that there was a strategic reserve somewhere behind us, but we reckoned recently, actually it's probably Dad's army, because as far as I know, there wasn't any strategic reserve left after Dunkirk. Except my own division, 43rd Wessex Division, I think was more or less intact and was a strategic defence force, but I don't think it was in the Kent area at that time.
What happened to you next?
Well, the next thing was that they discovered that I had taken electricity and magnetism in school certificate and that I was a potential radar expert. So I was then, and this was the end of 1940, I was then sent on a 6 months course of electronics to Brighton Technical College, and then another, I think it was 3 months, at the Ordnance Depot at Kidbrook in South East London to learn about this newfangled radar. And the particular radar I was involved in was called Radar CDCHL, which was Coastal Defence Radar. And when I finished this course, I was put in charge of the maintenance, repair, and general sort of supervision of six radar stations based between New Haven and Littlehampton. linked to coastal defence batteries. And these were low beam radar to detect shipping, and again linked to the coastal batteries, of which there are a whole series. New Haven had one, there was a battery at Brighton, another one at Worthing, and so on. I may say that one of my most devastating experiences was shortly after I'd taken over, and I may say it was really a bit of a sort of blind leading the blind, because radar was very much in its infancy in those days. Suddenly one night I was called out because all the X lines were shattering with grass, and I didn't know what the hell this was all about. But the next morning we discovered that the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau had passed through the channel. And I was not in the best frame of mind. That I suppose I had a slight guilt complex that I hadn't controlled this situation, and that I was partially responsible for the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau getting down the channel. What we discovered later was that this was all done by German window, you know, dropping window, which shattered our X line. And it was our first experience of this, and nobody had told me about window or anything like that. So this was, I suppose, in 1941.
Channel breakout was February 1942.
Was it? Oh, well, that then it was February 42. Well, then immediately after that, I was singled out to go to Octave.
What did that involve?
I had a 6-week sort of induction course, and I can't remember quite where it was. It was somewhere in Sussex. I then went for 2 weeks to Rootham, which was a pre-Octu course, and then off to 1, 2, 3 Octu at Catterick, where I was commissioned into the field artillery.
What did you think of the Army's methods at that time of, as it were, creating officers?
Selection? I thought they were pretty effective, in fact. I mean, I don't know whether I really had officer qualities, but the fact was that I went through a series of being overseen, as well as taking the selection board thing. And then Rootham was a very toughening exercise, physically toughening. And the Octu, I thought, was extremely well run, really. It taught us quite a lot, and there was a certain amount of leadership instruction and testing one's initiatives and that kind of thing. It was a pretty all-round test, I think, of one's personal characteristics and leadership potential.
What did you think of the other people who were destined to become officers with whom you were?
I thought most of them were rather superior to me, actually. they were very high quality chaps, in fact, the fellows in my course. For example, one was the grandson of Lord Samuel. He was one. And there were other quite distinguished offspring, I thought. They were a good quality lot, actually.
And then?
Well, then I was posted to 112th Wessex Field Regiment of the 43rd Wessex Division. That was at the end of 1942. And we were based at Broadstairs in Kent at that time. Primarily in a defensive role, because at that time the threat of invasion hadn't passed. I think most of us felt pretty confident that nothing would ever happen, but at least, I mean, I remember on one occasion we had a red alert over invasion, and this was must have been in 1943. But our prime role was to prepare for D-Day or Normandy invasion.
What did that preparation involve you in personally?
A whole series of very uncomfortable trying exercises. We lived incredibly roughly most of the year in fields, hedges, that kind of thing. We had a battle course which was on the Royal St George's Golf Course at Sandwich, which was probably as frightening as anything I've been in Normandy, with very tough live ammunition situations. But our prime interest was in divisional exercises of various sorts all around the country. Almost incessantly we were out on very demanding exercises in cooperation with the infantry, for example, and with the rest of the gunners. Most of our firing was done on the South Downs behind Brighton and through to places like Alfriston and that kind of area. And we did a lot of live firing there and practiced gun control and communications, of which we became extraordinarily proficient, really.
Did you have a good idea of what you were preparing for?
I think very few of us had any doubts that we were going to invade probably the part of Calais, I assumed, in those days.
And next?
Well, that went on until D-Day. D-Day, we were put on immediate alert. And incidentally, I did record that, rather like Drake playing his bowls, I recorded that on D-Day and D plus one, I played cricket at the Saffron's Sussex County Cricket Ground. My diary doesn't record how unsuccessful I was in that, but it was rather interesting that with D-Day happening, we had left our cricket gear out. Everything else was packed to go to Normandy except our cricket gear, apparently. Which I have a personal diary, and reading that, I was rather amused at the idea that I was playing cricket on D-Day instead of battling away over to Normandy.
Can you tell me?
I am, incidentally, a very keen cricketer and MCC member and so on. Cricket was one of my religions.
Can you take me through the procedure of going across to Normandy step by step?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Can you give me a moment's silence? Because well, the code word we got was Mary, which seemed rather sort of mnemic code word to be at 6 hours' notice to move to Normandy. I may say that by this time, we had an enormous amount of confidence in ourselves and our abilities, and certainly in our division. We were commanded by a chap called Major General Butch Thomas, who was a very tough, resilient character, a World War hero with a DSO and a couple of MCs. And we had enormous respect for him as a leader, and fear, I may say. It was about 10 days before we got our orders to move up to Tilbury. And on the way up, we passed through Tunbridge and we passed through Southeast London. And it was really rather exhilarating because the whole of Southeast London turned out to cheer us across the river and down to Tilbury. There we were hung up for a couple of days loading a ship called Fort Assingbourne. It was an old Liberty ship that we were to go over in. And it took all my battery and a number of other units. During those 2 days, I may say, we experienced the first V1 flying bomb. And nobody had heard of it before. And we saw these planes flaming away, which we assumed had been shot and put set on fire. And then the engine stopped, and of course we were near the east end of London, and most of them were directed at the east end of London, and it was a rather terrifying experience, not necessarily for us, but certainly for the civilians around us. We then set off down the estuary and passed through the Cap de Grenay area, and we were rather surprised that we didn't attract any of the cross-channel gunfire from the Germans. I may say that I think, generally speaking, it's true to say, and I record this in my personal diary, that there was not a hell of a lot of tension. I remember that we took, I took communion. I'm a practicing Christian. A lot of us took communion, and we had hymn singing on board, which was probably one of the more emotional experiences pre-landing that we had. It was, I may say, interrupted somewhat by gunfire from whatever direction we didn't know. And then, as we approached the beaches, it was an unfortunate coincidence that the storm blew up. And we were 4 days pitching and tossing and turning. Every night there were air raids on the shipping. We were aware that the mines were floating around. And we were all incredibly seasick, all except one, my chum of mine, who was a sailor, and he wasn't affected. The rest of us suffered enormously from seasickness, and we could see all the shooting going on ashore. It was, by this time, it was about D plus 12, 14, something like that. I can't remember exactly what the D was. About four days. Now, the most harrowing experience was that one night the ship next door to us was blown up by a mine, and it contained the 43rd Wessex Division Reconnaissance Regiment. The ship sank, and I think it was something like 130 of the recce regiment were killed, drowned, and all their equipment lost. So we were without a reconnaissance regiment for 3 weeks. The storm abated, and it was another day before an LCI came alongside. And I was put in charge of not only my own troop, but also of a troop of 15 Scottish divisions anti-tank guns. And more interestingly, perhaps, the first detachment ashore of the Wargraves Commission. And so I was put in charge of this lot, and we set off from the ship, Assinbourne, at 1 o'clock in the morning, absolutely pitch black. We had no idea which beach we were due to land on, because there was so much chaos around us. I mean, the whole of the... so many ships had been stranded and beached and God knows what. And we got ashore, as I say, in pitch blackness, about 1:30 in the morning, to be met by a very casual beachmaster who directed us through the cleared minefield path into a shattered village. And he told me, when you get to the road, turn right. The fact was that we hadn't the vaguest idea of where to go or what to do, and so I decided to lager for the rest of that night in a field. And next morning was transformation. There was 43rd West Divisional signs everywhere directing us to our assembly point, and 15 Scottish signs directing the anti-tank troop. What happened to the Wargraves Commission, gentlemen, I don't know. But the other rather interesting thing was that I discovered that the field in which we'd lagered had a sign called Achtung Minen in it, which meant that we were probably lagered in a minefield. Nothing went off, fortunately. So we then assembled just outside Bayeux, and we immediately went into action. The beachhead in our part was, I think, by this time about 8 miles deep. And we were, our first gun position was at a village called Show, which was utterly devastated. And the first gun position introduced us to all the horrors of war, really, because A, it was being shelled, B, it was covered in sour milk, because it was next door to a milk depot which had been shelled, and there were literally thousands of gallons of rancid milk flowing all over the countryside. And our gun position was in the middle of it, and it was a most appalling smell. Not only was there that, but there was also a herd of dead cows with their legs in the air, which were very bloated and decomposing. So altogether, it was a pretty unpleasant experience of our first gun position. We immediately started into a barrage situation. This was in support of 15th Scottish Division's attack, which was on the Odon, the River Odon, and across the Odon with the 11th Armoured Division. And unfortunately, it made no progress. And that night, or perhaps it was the next night, we were out in an anti-tank roll because there was the report that the Germans had mounted a counterattack which was breaking through. In fact, it never reached our gun position. From then on, we moved next to near Carpiquet Aerodrome overlooking Caen, where we were again in action, firing in support of the Canadians in an attack on Carpiquet Aerodrome and down towards Caen. And our own division was in reserve. waiting to take over from 15th Scottish and 11th Armoured. We had Cong within our visual range because Carpiquet was up on a hill and our gun positions were up on a hill and very exposed, I may say, to counter battery work. And I watched the 450 or plus strategical bombers destroy Cong. And it occurred to me, and I never changed my mind, that the use of strategical bombers in a close tactical role was terribly counterproductive in a number of senses. First of all, they had to leave a safety zone because they were strategical bombing, which usually left the German forces on the wrong side of the bombing. Secondly,